Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Mack v. McCann. Mr. Steinhoff.
Good morning, judges. It's a pleasure to appear before you. This obviously is a appeal in a habeas case, and because the legal issues depend upon a correct understanding of the facts, and also because the state in this case has bounced around from theory to theory during the course of this litigation as to what could possibly justify this extended term sentence, I just want to run over a few basic facts. Larry Mack was sentenced to an extended term of natural life imprisonment. There is no question that under Illinois law that he was not eligible for such an extended term sentence unless there was a certain finding. There is no question that there is no jury verdict making those findings which would make him eligible for an extended term sentence.
So then the only question he wants to present to a jury is whether the shooting was knowing or intentional.
And we presented that.
Is that
we
correct?
Had a very extensive trial in 2001. This was not some abbreviated sentencing hearing taking a couple of hours in an afternoon. This was a two-week jury trial of the highest importance, where the state was aggressively seeking to sentence my client to death.
So under your theory, do we have the possibility that the jury verdict at sentencing will contradict the trial court's verdict during the guilt phase? Because it seems that may be what happened here. The trial court found as an element of the crime that the shooting was knowing or intentional, and then the 2001 jury could not agree that it was knowing or intentional.
In fact, the 2001 jury was even a little bit more than that, because there has been significant misrepresentations as to what occurred in 2001. There was a unanimous jury verdict, no question about that, signed by all 12 jurors. It was the most favorable jury verdict that my client could receive, given the state's strategy in the case, where they didn't attempt to put before the jury additional grounds for imposition of the extended term. Is there a conflict between the verdicts? Yes, I think there is. There's no question about that, and there's no question that the facts that were brought out at the 2001 trial were significantly different from the facts that were brought out at the 1981 trial.
So your view is the state is relying on an earlier verdict that was based on less information and, as in your view, inaccurate information in light of the 2001 verdict. Am I right?
There's no question that's not quite the argument, because my argument is goes beyond that. Had there been a jury verdict in 1981 which found the factors necessary to impose an extended term sentence, I wouldn't be having this argument here. Because then, if there was a jury verdict, that would arguably supply the grounds necessary for imposition of an extended term sentence. My argument then would be a little different. It would then be more concentrating on the conflict between the jury verdict in 2001 and the bench trial verdict in 1981. There's no question there's a conflict between them. But my point is this. It's a little different. It is that under Apprendi, and now there is no question, everyone seems to have accepted at this point, although they didn't earlier in this litigation, that Apprendi applies, and Apprendi rules in this case, and in fact all the Apprendi cases up to 2005 apply, but the only one I really need is Apprendi, 2000, that there must be a jury verdict. There must be a jury verdict. That is the point of Apprendi.
If Mack had waived a jury for all purposes, would the findings from the guilt phase be sufficient to sentence him to natural life?
I think under this court's precedent, it would be. Yeah. And that is essentially the case they rely on from this court is Jones against Hulick. Completely different set of facts. He waived a jury. He waived it for everything. He waived it for the guilt. He waived it for the eligibility. He waived it for the imposition of sentence. Completely different case.
During his trial and on the issue of guilt.
Yes.
He did waive a jury with is that document or is that transcript in this record?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Where will I find that?
It certainly is in the record, and I thought it
was
in...
Is that a very crucial document?
And it's absolutely in the record, and there's no question as to what that waiver says. The waiver is extremely explicit. It says this waiver is for sentencing, is for guilt innocence only, and is not for sentencing. And certainly that waiver is set forth in my brief. It's certainly in the record in this case. In fact, Judge Castillo made a point of getting in the record. He wanted to see what that jury waiver said.
It's 1097 of the appendix.
Okay, thank you, Judge. So there is no question that jury waiver was only for guilt innocence.
At the time, this was a death case.
Yes.
And everybody was focusing on the fact that he didn't want to waive a jury in the penalty phase of the death case.
Correct. But the jury waiver didn't say this jury waiver is only for death penalty sentencing. It doesn't limit the sentencing. It says this waiver is not for sentencing. Couldn't be more explicit. The judge, not only is there a written jury waiver, there's a transcript, which is also in the record, where the judge specifically admonishes Mr. Mack, this is not for sentencing. This is for guilt, innocence only, not for sentencing. His lawyer tells him that. The prosecutor tells him that. There is no confusion about this. That jury waiver in 1981, which is critical to the determination of this case, is only limited... It is limited only to the guilt-innocence phase.
Mr. Stainthorpe,
yes.
Mack seems to be saying that the guilty verdict was incorrect because the evidence now shows that both shots were fired accidentally, that only one bullet passed
yes.
through the victim, and that there was no intentional execution of the bank guard, of Mr. Kolar. Why didn't Mack mount an actual innocence claim under Mack's under the sentencing theory here? It would seem that he was at most guilty of negligent homicide.
He's guilty of murder. He is. There's no question because he's robbing a bank, and it doesn't matter whether he does it accidentally or how he does it. He's guilty of murder. He's eligible for a 40-year sentence. There's no question about that, and he has never contested that. In fact, you know, minutes after he was arrested, he acknowledged, I shot the security guard, but I'm sorry, it was a mistake, and I did it accidentally. So there is no question that he's guilty of murder, and I have never challenged that. But there is a question, and obviously this was the issue that was litigated in 2001 about his intent and knowledge. And that is what the jury returned, a unanimous verdict, not a hung jury, a unanimous verdict, saying we cannot find that the state proved him eligible because it's two things. In the verdict, they say because he's not 18 or can't find an aggravating factor. There's no question he was 18. Everyone agrees that. So the only issue was his intent or knowledge at the time of the shooting. And that is what the state lost on in 2001. And significantly, had they prevailed on that, that would have made Mr. Mack eligible both for a death sentence, and then if the jury had determined not to sentence him to death, which they obviously had the right to do, he would have been eligible for natural life. So if the state had prevailed at the 2001 hearing at the eligibility stage, and as the court knows, in Illinois you have a two-stage death penalty hearing. First you have to find the person eligible, and then the jury determines whether in fact to sentence him to death. We won at the first stage. We never got to the second stage. The jury said he's not eligible. We're finding he's not eligible. Not a hung jury. A unanimous finding. Now, had they found him eligible, and then had they determined in their exercise of discretion not to sentence him to death, he would have been eligible for a natural life sentence, because then a jury would have found the necessary predicate to impose a natural life sentence. That didn't happen. What happened was the reverse. The jury said, we cannot unanimously find that. There is no jury verdict finding the necessary facts to impose an extended term sentence. It doesn't exist. Now, at various times there's been misrepresentations as to that in this litigation, but the fact is clear. It doesn't exist. There's no jury verdict finding the facts necessary to impose an extended term sentence.
What and where were the misrepresentations, Mr. Stanhope?
Well, for one thing, in one of the opinions by the appellate court, amazingly, the opinion says he was found eligible for the death penalty. That's an incredible misrepresentation, because the Illinois Supreme Court said he wasn't. That was the whole basis for the death penalty being overturned. At various points in the pleadings by the state, there have been misrepresentations that he was found eligible for the death penalty. He wasn't. There have been misrepresentations as to the verdict in 2001 as it being a hung jury. It wasn't. It was a unanimous verdict in our favor. And it was the most favorable that could be entered in this case. So, if the state had wanted to proceed on a different theory in 2001 as to him being eligible for an extended term, they could have. They decided to go on one theory, which was that he was eligible for the death penalty. If he was eligible for the death penalty, he was eligible for an extended term. The jury found he wasn't. He wasn't eligible for an extended term. So, based on that, and based on the fact that Apprendi unquestionably requires a jury verdict of the facts necessary to impose an extended term, it's clear that that did not occur here. And the only only argument could be that by this limited jury waiver that occurred in 1981, that somehow waived his right to a jury for sentencing. And that's an argument which I set forth at length in my brief, and which is completely unanswered in the state's brief. Not a word about it. Not a word about jury waivers. It takes up about 7 pages of my brief, and they didn't respond to it in the slightest. Jury waivers for sentencing, there's no question. They have the same standards as jury waivers for guilt-innocence. So if they wanted to, if that jury waiver in 1981 was to be valid for sentencing, it had to be knowing, intelligent, and obviously it wasn't because he was told it wasn't for sentencing. So only by a complete perversion of the words of that jury waiver could the state prevail in this case. So I think my time is up.
I just want to remind, it's your time, but I just want to remind you your
yeah. Well, unless there are more questions, I will at this point cede to the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stainer. Mr. Feinerman?
May it please the court, Mr. Stainthorpe, I'm Gary Feinerman from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, here on behalf of Respondent Appellee Terry McGann. Mac's natural life sentence does not violate Apprendi, and at a minimum, rejecting Mac's Apprendi claim is not an objectively unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent. The governing principle is that there's no Apprendi violation if the sentence imposed is at or below the statutory maximum. And the statutory maximum under Apprendi is the maximum sentence that a judge may impose based solely on the facts inherent in the guilty verdict, whether that verdict is entered by a jury or if the defendant waives a jury at the guilt phase by the trial judge. And that's an important point, because Mr. Stainthorpe seems to concede that if a jury had made the finding of intent at the 1981 guilt phase, that that would be sufficient to establish a statutory maximum of natural life. And he makes a distinction between the jury verdict and the trial and the verdict by the trial judge. But he waived a jury.
Can I try and talk this out with you?
Of course.
Problems. Under the state's theory of sentencing, no sentencing hearing would have been required in this case for a natural life sentence, right?
That's correct.
Indeed, under your argument, if a person is convicted under the knowing or intentional part of the murder statute, and the murder occurs during a felony that's one of those that's listed in that section 6C of the aggravating factors statute, there'd be no reason to hold the eligibility phase of a death penalty hearing, right?
Under Illinois law, there would be a requirement under Illinois procedure, that's section 91D, 91F, and 91G under Illinois procedure.
So the defendant would not be automatically eligible?
For purposes of the federal constitution, for purposes of Apprendi, yes, he would be automatically eligible to go to the second phase of the capital sentencing hearing. That's Waldrop and all the cases we cited in our brief.
But such a hearing was held here. It was held twice, once in 1981 and once in 2001.
And that's because Illinois law gave Mr. Mack a procedural right that he was not given by the federal constitution to have an eligibility hearing where he could actually ask the jury to refine the facts that had already been established beyond a reasonable doubt at the guilt phase.
So in other words, what you're saying is, let me just get this straight, the way the Illinois statute operates apparently creates the possibility that there can be different conclusions about the knowing and intentional nature of a murder in the guilt phase and the sentencing phase? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. The way it normally happens, let's say you have the same jury for the guilt phase and the sentencing phase. My understanding is that what often happens is if the jury returns a verdict of intentional murder, that the defendant was the trigger man, and that it was committed during a felony, that already establishes capital eligibility. And what will happen in those situations oftentimes is that the defendant will waive the eligibility hearing, because why have the jury make the same finding that it already made?
Well, why was the 2001 sentencing hearing necessary?
Because the state wanted to get a death sentence for Mr. Mack.
No, but under your argument, he would have been automatically eligible for a death sentence. The only fact he contested was whether the shooting was knowing or voluntary, and you argued that the trial court's finding on this fact was conclusive for all purposes, including sentencing. Was the necessity of that hearing contested by the state? I am very...
Let me try and explain it. For purposes of, and I'm going to make a distinction between Mr. Mack's federal constitutional rights and his rights under Illinois procedure. As a matter of the federal constitution of Apprendi, and this was held in Waldrop, the Alabama Supreme Court's decision in Waldrop, and all those other cases that we cited on page 32 of our brief. For purposes of the federal constitution, he did not have a right to a death eligibility hearing because the facts that made him eligible for a capital sentence had already been found beyond a reasonable doubt at the guilt phase. But Illinois law, as Illinois is entitled to do, gives capital defendants rights greater than that to which they are entitled under the federal constitution. And as a matter of Illinois procedure, and of course Illinois procedure doesn't come into play in a federal habeas proceeding, as a matter of Illinois procedure, he actually got capital defendants, including Mr. Mack, actually get a second bite at the apple.
So, but you seem to be arguing that the 2001 verdict is a nullity, a non-decision.
It is a non-decision under Illinois law.
Well, does that mean that the state could again seek the death penalty, or would you concede here that double jeopardy would bar another bite at that?
Let me answer that question in two ways. As a matter of the federal constitution, no. I'm sorry, yes, the state can go for the death penalty again if this case were remanded, and that's the Satizon case. Unless there's an acquittal at the capital eligibility phase, the state can try again to establish capital eligibility. And I really do have to take issue with Mr. Stainthorpe in terms of what this verdict was. Under People versus Hipkins, which we cited in our brief at page 42 and 43, when the jury comes back at a capital eligibility hearing and is unable to unanimously conclude that there was a capital eligibility factor, that is not an affirmative finding that an aggravating factor did not exist. And that ties into the way that the death penalty works in Illinois. Under Section 91D, 91F, and 91G, which is on page 22 of our supplemental appendix, in order to get to the second phase of a capital sentencing hearing, there has to be a unanimous finding at the first phase that the defendant was death eligible. In order to win at the first phase, all the defendant needs at the first phase is one vote. That's all he needs. He doesn't need 12. He doesn't need a unanimous decision in his favor. All he needs is a split decision, one vote. And in fact, Mr. Stainthorpe, contrary to what he's telling you right here, told the jury exactly that in his closing argument in 2001. This is on page 238D of the transcript of October 10th, 2001. He said, "If any one of you finds that there is reasonable doubt and that the state has not satisfied their burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, any one of you, then your verdict must be that he is not eligible for the death penalty." And that's what happened here. And in a situation like that, where the jury is unable to unanimously find that the defendant is death eligible, there's no second hearing. But also, under People v. Hipkins, there's no acquittal. And because there's no acquittal, the state can try again, and that's Satizon versus Pennsylvania. Now, for purposes of the federal constitution, the state can try again. There may be state procedural rules that will preclude the state. I don't know. That's up to the Cook County State's Attorney's Office if this case gets remanded. But I want to touch upon what the waiver was in 1981. And Judge Ripple, to answer your question, the written waiver is found at Appendix D of the petitioner's appendix, and the transcript is found at Appendix E of the petitioner's appendix. What he did was he waived. This was not a waiver of his right to a jury at a sentencing hearing. So he preserved his right to a jury at a sentencing hearing. So the question is, what right did he have at a sentencing hearing? And what right didn't he have? And I'll focus on the second question first. He didn't have a right to a jury at a sentencing hearing if the judge were going to impose a sentence that was within the statutory maximum that had already been authorized by the beyond a reasonable doubt findings made at the guilt phase of the hearing. That's the White case by this court. That's Jones. And the premise...
I don't understand why you think Jones controls this case.
It's on all fours.
Jones waived the jury for both guilt and sentencing.
That wasn't the basis...
And that discussion was probably dicta because the claim had already been found untimely. I don't get your reliance on Jones at all, Mr. Feinerman.
Mr. Jones was found guilty at a bench trial of murder during an aggravated vehicular hijacking. It made him eligible for a natural life sentence under the same statute at issue here, Section 91B6. And the court held that those guilt phase findings, standing alone, are a sufficient predicate for a natural life sentence. We're making the same argument here. There's People versus Rivera, which makes the same finding from the Illinois Appellate Court, and there are those other cases on page 32 of our brief. Could the Jones court have decided the case on a narrower ground? Yes, it could have. And in fact, in White versus Battaglia, the court chose those narrower grounds.
So how do we factor in the fact that Jones waived the jury for both phases, the guilt and sentencing?
For purposes of the court's explanation of why there was no Apprendi violation, it doesn't matter at all because the court focused on the guilt phase findings. And that's absolutely correct because, remember, Apprendi says that you don't have a right, the defendant does not have a right to additional fact findings so long as the sentence imposed is within the statutory maximum already established by the guilty verdict, by the facts inherent in the guilty verdict.
Is it your view that there's some state court decision here which we are obliged to defer to?
You're obliged to defer to the judgment of the state appellate court in this case.
Even though the state courts didn't address
the
Apprendi argument?
The state actually, right, we're relying on different grounds than the state appellate court did in both of its opinions. In all fairness,
it's the most unusual situation to have had the prosecutor.
Not at all. The state has made the argument that I'm making here at the sentencing hearing in 2001, and that's it's the G series of transcripts. It made the argument in the state appellate court brief, made the argument in front of Judge Castillo, and we were successful the second time in front of Judge Castillo. So we've been consistent throughout, and that's the argument we're making here. Getting back to this waiver point, he said he preserved the right to have the jury re-find the facts that had already been found, the finding of intent that had already been found at the guilty phase. But he didn't have that right to preserve, either before Apprendi or after Apprendi.
So he was lulled, fooled into writing this waiver of his right to trial by jury. Is that
absolutely not? Let's say he said, "Okay, I'm going to be really explicit here. I'm preserving my right to have the jury refine facts that will have already been found beyond a reasonable doubt by the trial judge at the guilt phase." And the trial judge would have looked at him and said, "You don't have that right." He didn't have that right before Apprendi, certainly, and he doesn't have that right after Apprendi.
This is a nullity.
It's not a nullity at all. I'll tell you what two rights he preserved. He preserved his procedural right under Illinois law to have the jury decide death eligibility, and if he is eligible, to decide whether there were mitigating factors sufficient to preclude a sentence of death. That's a procedural right that's given to him by Illinois law and not by the federal Constitution. He preserved a second right, although he did, unless he had remarkable foresight, he didn't know he was preserving this right. But he was also preserving his substantive right under the federal Constitution to have the jury find any additional facts, and by that I mean facts not inherent in the guilty verdict, that would be used to impose a sentence above the statutory maximum permitted by the facts that were inherent in the verdict of guilt.
What good did his writing, "I, the undersigned, do hereby waive jury trial and submit the above entitled clause to the court for hearing. This waiver is for initial hearing, not a waiver of his right to a jury at a sentencing hearing." Signed, Larry P.
I just
Mack.
Said he preserved his right under Illinois law that's not given to him by the federal Constitution to have a jury decide capital eligibility, to decide this very same things that had already been found at the guilt phase, and also to the extent that there were any factual findings that would increase the statutory maximum beyond that which he was already exposed to by virtue of the guilty verdict. Let's say that Mack was found guilty only of felony murder and not of intentional murder. That would not have exposed him to a natural life term because factor 6 under section 9(1)(b) requires intent, and it also requires that the murder be committed during a felony. Okay, so let's say he was just found guilty of felony murder. At that point, the statutory maximum would have only been 40 years, and he was preserving the right to have a jury then go find intent. The additional facts that would increase the statutory maximum above to that to which he was already exposed. May I complete my thought? But the fact is, the court found him guilty the trial judge found him guilty of intentional murder and felony murder. And that got him into, and because of those two findings, that got him into the factor six territory. He was already exposed to a natural life sentence. He had no right to preserve. He had no right to waive.
So this is, for him, in reality, a total nullity.
Absolutely not. He preserved his right.
Well, I mean, you know, it's sort of Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
Absolutely not. He signed. May I answer the question? He signed the waiver before he knew what was going to happen at the guilt phase. He didn't know if he was going to be found guilty. He didn't know he was going to be found guilty of all
isn't
three theories of intentional murder.
Isn't that always the case?
Yes.
Isn't it always the case? So, you know, he's signing this, and today it's meaningless.
It became
it's meaningless.
No, it's not meaningless. It saved him from the death penalty. It saved him from a capital sentence.
How do we know that?
We know that because he had the right to have a jury find capital eligibility, and that capital eligibility finding was invalidated in 1995 by the Illinois Supreme Court.
He didn't know that at the time either.
If Illinois procedure gave him the rights that Alabama gives capital defendants down there, the trial judge could have gone straight to the aggravation mitigation stage and found that a death sentence was appropriate, and that would have been it. No reversal in 1995. So it actually saved his life, this waiver, because it gave him the right to have the jury verdict, to have a jury refine the facts that had already been found. Illinois law was very generous and still is in that respect. It also saved him, assuming that there was only one theory of murder found at the guilt phase, it would have saved him from a natural life sentence. So under the circumstances, it doesn't do anything for him because he already was exposed to a natural life sentence. But it could have prevented that as well had the verdict been different. Unless there are any further questions, we'd ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Byron. Mr. Stanto?
Thank you.
Thank you. With respect to that jury waiver, I would also note that it is further, there's the colloquy actually in open court concerning the jury waiver, where the court, the judge says, I think the document should reflect that this jury waiver is with respect to the initial phase, the guilt or innocence phase of the proceeding, and is not applicable to any subsequent sentencing hearing should there be a determination of guilt. Is that understood by everybody? Mr. Goggin, who was the prosecutor, yes, Judge. The court again, I think you should label it some way, initial hearing. Mr. Toole, who was the defense attorney, I have indicated, not a waiver to the right of jury in the sentencing hearing, the court, good. Nothing could be more explicit than that he's not waiving his right to...
Would you have an occasion now to speak to the People versus Hipkins issue? I notice it's not in... You didn't respond to that, did you?
That
the issue of the unanimous, how one interprets a...
Let me respond to that, because there was a significant misrepresentation as to both Illinois and constitutional law in the argument that we just heard, having to do with the double jeopardy implications of that verdict. And it's on page 19 and 20 of my reply brief. People versus West, Illinois Supreme Court, actually quoting a U.S. Supreme Court case, Bullington against Missouri, quote, a determination, either in the trial court or on review, that the defendant was not eligible for the death penalty would have operated as an acquittal on an element essential to a sentence of death. An acquittal. Satizan, the case on which the state relies, all has the same language. If a jury unanimously concludes, which happened here, that a state has failed to meet its burden of proving the existence of one or more aggravating circumstances, double jeopardy protections attach to that acquittal on the offense of murder plus aggravating circumstances. So there is no question that this was an acquittal, and that obviously has very significant double jeopardy protections. So I see my time is up, and if there...
You may make a concluding thought. You don't have to get cut off.
Well, this case is slap bang, down the middle, governed by Apprendi, and is governed by the well-established law relating to jury waivers. Mr. Mack had a right to have a jury determine whether he was eligible for an extended term sentence. That didn't happen. There was a full jury trial. The state failed in its attempt to establish that. And therefore, not only should there be a reversal of the district court, but there should be a determination by this court that there can be no subsequent sentencing hearing. The state had that sentencing hearing in 2001, and Mr. Mack prevailed. And that's it for it, for both death penalty and for an extended term sentence. Thank you very much.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.